Great. All right. Thanks a lot. This is my second time speaking here. So it's a pleasure to come. I love this city, this town. So I think this is familiar to what a lot of us were talking about last week in terms of what we're interested in. There's this wealth of connectomics data that we heard a lot about, we've been thinking a lot about. And I think the goal for many theorists is to relate this structural data here to the large-scale recordings that are now happening. This is some neuropixel stuff from Harris's lab in Genalia. So this is the goal here. We want to take this and say, how could our knowledge of this architecture produce this rich dynamical landscape? And we're not the first people to think about this. This is a long, long problem in theoretical neuroscience. Here's one of the earliest papers I could find where people wanted to talk about wiring in the brain and how it produces interesting dynamics. So this is work from Ashby in Nature way back in 1962. And what they did is they had a collection of threshold neurons, so neurons, binary neurons that produced either 0 or 1, depending on if their input was above some threshold theta. And they built one of the first sort of self-consistent field theories for sort of this premature neural network here, where they were asking, could we get a dynamical equation for the probability that one of these neurons in some unit time would produce an output, and this is going to be some function of the network itself. N is the number of axons, the number of inputs a neuron would get, and then theta is its threshold here. And these were all excitatory neurons. This is what made this network sort of special. And what Ashby and them found out in the end is indeed it's possible to have a fixed point in the system where you could have some moderate level of activity so that the system was neither completely saturated in activity or died out, but this sort of fixed point here was unstable, right? So any small perturbation away from this would cause you to go up to sort of epileptic activity or cause you to just, your network would die here. These are all identical neurons. Yeah, these are all identical pulse neurons, right? Exactly. So, and then they speculated in their, this is a really brief Nature paper, it's like a page and a half. No supplemental material, too, back in the 60s. So they said, well, you know what? This isn't a good model of the brain. There must be factors or mechanisms that stabilize real neural circuits so that we don't get this weird behavior. So we can have moderate levels of activity. Yes? So this is a feedback network here. This is a self-consistent, this arrow loops back onto itself. So we're doing these in a self-consistent way. That's right. So this is a network of excitatory neurons that loop self-consistently. So it's not a feed-forward structure.
It's all excitatory.
That's right. Now, you're absolutely right. People, this is sort of a funny, because we all know the answer to what we need here. We need inhibition, right? Inhibition was known before the 60s too, right? Hartline and Ratliff. And that they think, whenever I look at references for where inhibition first started to become prominent as a concept, is it not Hartline and Ratliff, or am I wrong?
Maybe in neuroscience.
In neuroscience, okay. This is a model of the brain. This was supposed to be a model of the brain.
Yeah.
Yep, and it's a bad one. Sure. So I don't think we any of the referees of the paper are in the room. So I don't know how this worked out, man. it's a page and a half paper. It's really interesting read. Quick read too. Cool. But the answer to this question, of course, is we know that inhibition is there to stabilize activity. And here, I'm sure this is not the first example, but sort of the more prominent ones is from Wilson and Cowan and sort of other authors at the time. Actually, the year following the Ashby paper, Griffith came out in Biophysical Journal and said the answer is inhibition. So it wasn't a long wait to solve this paradox here. But I'm going to sort of pull this quote out of Wilson and Cowan's famous paper, where they sort of said, you know what, all processes in the brain of any complexity require both excitation and inhibition. And they cited a bunch of people that were thinking about inhibition in the brain at the time, and they said, look, these citations are strong enough that we can basically take inhibition as a truism in the brain. And this is now sort of a silly statement. We all believe inhibition is a real thing, right? But even back then, it was something that wasn't taken exactly for granted here. So Wilson and Cowan sort of wrote down a pair of equations here. This is the firing rates of an excitatory pool of neurons. This is firing rates for an inhibitory pool of neurons. There's a low-pass filter dynamic for them. That's a sort of a phenomenological approach. And then there's some nonlinearity F here that maps inputs into outputs here. And this is sort of some bias current, and this is the coupling within the system here. And anytime you see a pair, if you're a dynamicist and you see a pair of equations like this, the first thing you want to do with the pair of dynamical equations is you want to find out where their zeros are, right? Where their zeros are going to be is going to tell you where the fixed points of the system are. So I'm colleagues with Bart Ehrmantraut, and I was hanging out in his office one day, and we were rifling through his desk, or he was rifling through his desk, and he found this kind of cool picture. And this is from when he was a postdoc with John Rinzel in 1979. And if anybody's ever tried to compute null clines, it's hard. It's not trivial to compute null clines. I mean, today's world, you just do contour F in MATLAB, but that didn't exist in the 70s, right? So if you want to compute null clines, it's tricky. And Bard, I assume Bard, not John, wrote some fancy algorithm here to do this. But in order to display the null cline structure, they had to do it on an oscilloscope and then take some picture. Right? So this is like a super old null cline picture, and this cubic null cline here is the zeros of the solution for the top equation. That's the excitatory null cline, and this sigmoidal null cline here is the zeros to the solution of the inhibitory null cline, and they intersect right in the middle here. And I think our community's been obsessed for a long time about middle branch intersections for null clines for a very, very long time, since the early 70s here. So I'm putting this up to say that we've talked about inhibition and excitation for a very long time, and that... good point. I asked Bard. I don't know. That's a good point. I don't know what this axis means, right? I mean, I assume it means E rate and I rate, right? Right. So what I'll do to satisfy you is just get rid of the numbers, Misha. That's cool. That's what we'll do, all right? There you go. So this picture has been around for a long time, and I'll give sort of three examples where this picture is still relatively useful to bring intuition to the table. And sort of one of them is from Misha himself. And so he along with McNaughton and Signowski and others, sort of made this observation that there's this paradoxical effect, and Jeff Isaacson talked about this last week, where if you end up giving an overall bias to inhibitory neurons, the consequence of that bias is that over time, the inhibitory neuron firing rate will go down. So you give a positive input to eye cells, and in this recurrent system, over time, so this is exactly the idea, this is the way that Ken likes to think of it. He likes to think of a center stimulus being applied, and then a surround stimulus being applied at a later point. And then the surround stimulus will drive recurrent inhibition in the system. So inhibition will go up, so it'll drive the inhibitory neurons more than the excitatory neurons. But so transiently, you get this depolarization or increase in firing rate of the eye cells. But over time, they sort of settle to a lower firing rate than they would if the surround had not been present here. And I understand this by saying, well, look, if you live on the middle branch, if you're going to suppress the E cells, you have to suppress the I cells, right? The intersection lies on this middle branch. So if one population's fire rate goes up, the other one has to go up. If one goes down, the other one has to go down. Right? That's the way I like to think of it. So another classic example, of course, is from Heim and Carl van Riesvik and others, when they sort of looked at balanced networks. So formally in this null cline picture for a balanced network in the large system size limit, the large and large K limit, this becomes linear here. And we don't want to live in these saturated regimes, so that's silly. So you get this linear dynamic, and sort of the beauty of balanced networks is you have this linearity, but really what you have is trough-to-trough fluctuations. You scale the system or the interactions in the system such that the variability doesn't vanish in the large end limit, and you get variability that comes out of this here. So that's another example where EI dynamics are able to solve interesting things that people have reported in the brain for a long time. And sort of the last one, this was really the first result, that this really comes from Wilson and Cowan, that they were really interested in rhythms. I mean, they're dynamics people. So dynamics people tend to like limit cycles more than fixed points. For whatever reason, they're more interesting. So Wilson and Cowan said, well, let's make the inhibitory neurons a little slower than the excitatory neurons. And then what happens here is you're going to destabilize this point and you'll get some limit cycle oscillation. And typically this is a gamma-like activity, and gamma oscillations have been reported in the brain for a long time. So we can talk about how the cortex is stable with inhibition. We can talk about how the cortex is stable with inhibition. It can produce rhythms with inhibition, and it can produce variability. And these are all different faces of the stability mechanism. Another thing that people talk a lot about is neuronal gain control. I'll talk about how inhibition plays a role in this in a second. So this is contrast gain control. So here you're looking at how the tuning curve of a cell in V1 changes as a function of the contrast of the oriented bar, and overall this is just a scaling of this tuning curve. This is sort of bottom up responses. We also know that we can cause gain control or gain modulations of responses from top down processes, where if you can direct attention into the receptive field of a neuron, you'll get an overall multiplicative scaling of the response function here. This is work from John Monsell's group, but there's been several other people. David's got a nice review on this, where this is not the only kind of gain control. You can also get subtractive effects. It depends a lot on the details. But there's top-down influences of gain. People have been hypothesizing that inhibition plays a role in this gain control. So Christoph Koch and Rodney Douglas back in the 90s sort of had this view where we could explain gain control much in the way that Ohm's law works. So if you overall give inhibition to a system, then you'll change the ohmic relations of a neuron. And they had this idea that if you divide the voltage, you'll also divide the firing rates, and you get this overall gain change. It's nice to think that, but people have shown that that's not really true. Ohm's law doesn't pass through the spiking nonlinearities of a system. But Larry Abbott and others, I think my very, very first paper as a young undergrad was there, where in an open loop scenario, if you have some stochastic bombardment of excitation and inhibition that impinges a neuron, this is actually dynamic clamp experiments from Alexis Reyes's lab back in the day, then you could, if you fine-tune things properly, as you tune up the amount of balanced excitation and inhibition in the system, you end up reducing the gain of the response of some postsynaptic cell here. All right, so inhibition has been theorized to play a role in gain control, both in feedback and sort of feed-forward frameworks. And sort of the last thing I want to talk about before we get into the meat of some models is population-wide variability, noise correlations here. So we've talked a lot about this. This is sort of an example data set from Adam Cohen and Matt Smith. They did a lot of work on this in the early days. This was actually collected, I think, in Tony Mobshin's lab when Adam was a postdoc and Matt was a grad student there. And noise correlations are just the idea that you're going to take, you have a pair of responses, and you're going to look at the covariance of the spike counts. Usually this is over some reasonable window, 100 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds. And you normalize by the geometric mean of the variances, and you look at sort of this noise correlation here ends up being 0.24, and it's really because the spread of these dots is along some ellipse here. This is a review that I wrote a couple years ago, where I sort of went into the literature and looked at how noise correlations are now, they've been interesting for a while from a coding point of view, but I think another interesting aspect is they're a really good signature of state modulations. So this is a ton of different preps. So electric fish, a bunch of monkey preps, and then you have some mice preps as well in vision, and then other areas. And each one of these papers records a population of neurons in one of two states. Either the states are low versus high arousal, untrained versus trained, spontaneous versus evoked, that kind of thing. And what I'm reporting here is the ratio of the average correlation in state B versus state A. State B is always the one that was the smaller correlations. That was the convention I took here.
I think this is the maximum.
This is the average. The average over all their pairwise correlations.
No, but you take for the pairwise correlation, you look at the
So a lot of these are all typically, I think the window length here, the shortest guy I have, there's a 1 millisecond weird one here, but most of these are big windows, 100 milliseconds, 600, so they're looking at spike counts over some reasonable size window. So that might, it'll include that in many of these cases. It's firing rate fluctuations. Firing rates measured over these windows. That's right. So we're not talking about synchrony. Synchrony would be, this one is a synchrony one here, and then this one is too. So that's the same thing. You can still have spike count correlations. Well, you can have spike count correlations over whatever window size you want, but if the window size gets smaller than the average ISI, it starts to get into what I would call synchrony. So this is really spike count correlations here. So the point here is there's a ton of modulation. In many of these states, correlations can drop by a factor of two, right? Two or three. So correlations are a good measure of state change in a system. Okay. So where does inhibition play a role in producing noise correlations? So Jeff talked a little bit about this last week. This is really sort of stolen from a really great paper from Alfonso Renard and Jaime de la Rocha when they were in Ken Harris's lab, where they looked at densely coupled balanced networks. So in the work that Haim had done and Danny Amit and Nicolas Brunel, these were typically sparse networks. But in densely wired networks where there was non-negligible shared inputs into cells, because you couldn't just approximate it away as being order epsilon, then you'll have sizable correlations due to common excitatory projections. So here's a pair of, this is the correlations into a pair of neurons. In green is the correlations due to the common excitation going into them, and then this, you could see this here, this is in this paper from Ilan Lampel, where you have the excitatory inputs going into a pair of cells are fairly correlated. The same is true for inhibition into a pair of neurons, that's the red. This is when you depolarize the cell, so they're both sitting at around the reversal of the E-channel, the excitatory inputs, and then the only thing left is inhibitory pulses. So you get lots of correlated inhibition, lots of correlated excitation. There might be correlated external inputs, that's in blue here, but the sort of the magic of these balanced networks is you put all these things together and you just put them in a pot and stir them up and you get no correlations in the output, or very, very weak correlations in the output. And the reason for that is the inhibition going into one cell is going to be anti-correlated with the excitation going into the other cell, because inhibition has a minus sign, right? That's it, there's a minus sign for inhibition. So you put all this together and you get very, very weak correlations in your output here. Okay, that's the way I like to think of it. So what have I told you here? Inhibition has a bunch of jobs. Networks need to be stable, inhibition's gotta do it. Networks need to be subject to gain control. Inhibition's a favorite culprit. Yes? This one? Sure. This is Alfonso and Jaime, but what they're plotting here is they're plotting so the black is the correlations. They're looking at a pair of neurons. This is in their network, right? And they're looking, this would be the black, would be the total correlations going into that pair of neurons, and that's the black, and it's small. Yeah, I'm sure this is, it was dense, but random, yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And I asked Ilan why did he not plot the fourth one, and he said he didn't do it. And this is a great point. Is so Alfonso and Jaime have this is really, really small, right? He told me that it was smaller. The total correlations were smaller, but they weren't smaller by an order of magnitude. Anybody that puts a pair of, this goes back to a point that David made. I really love these whole David Kleinfeld. There's too many Davids here. David Kleinfeld. There you go. So anybody that puts a pair of whole cell electrodes in vivo prep and asks what the correlation coefficient of the currents are into those neurons, without playing these games, just what's the raw correlation, they don't come away with a number like 0.001. They come away with a number like 0.2 or 0.3.
So it's not the same thing.
That's right, yeah. So this is a wrench, this is a huge wrench in Alfonso and Jaime's paper, is that They theorize that things are uncorrelated, that the cortex is uncorrelated because of this cancellation at the level of the presynaptic inputs combining in the system. And when anybody looks to see if that's true, they don't get that answer. Yep. They did, yes.
And they show in one figure that in spiking neuron you can get high correlation due to the orbit to the eye-to-eye coupling.
Yeah.
So if you do it in spiking model, you can get different results.
You can get different results, you can get correlated activity. Yep.
I'm sorry, maybe it just has to be offline because they just don't get it.
Sure.
If the excitatory and inhibitory currents you're saying add and nullify each other, and you're saying the amount of current that's left,
no, it's that you have I'm a pair of neurons. I have each neuron gets excitation and inhibition,
yeah.
Right? If this is the pair of neurons have correlated excitations, let's call the degree of that correlation A. Let's just label it A. A is some number, right? And then inhibition comes into that pair of neurons as well, and that's correlating them. And for ease of mathematics, let's also say that that's A. So the total correlation from just the EE and the EI pathways would be 2A. But now you have to do the correlation between E into one neuron and I into the other neuron. And then there's also I into that guy and E into this guy. And then you have minus 2A. So you have A plus A minus 2A equals zero. That's the platonic version of what they say.
That's perfect balance.
That's perfect balance. That's cancellation at the level of second order correlations. I mean, order of magnitude, it was more that it's an order that this black line is tiny compared to all the other lines. So the question is it the same order or is it much smaller? Is it an order of magnitude smaller? And in their model, it's an order of magnitude smaller. And I think what Misha and I are talking about is that's not totally true in data. You can get spiking network models to have pretty weak correlations too, can't you? If you have synaptic delay, absolutely. And if inhibition is slower than excitation, absolutely. They had a spiking network model and it worked. No delay. The time scale of inhibition and excitation were exactly the same. Both of those things aren't true in reality. Right? And I'll get back, I'll hopefully get back to a point on this. We'll see how, I want my cookies, so we're going to do that.
Current means random?
It's Erdős-Rényi. So in their framework, it was an Erdős-Rényi graph that had dense wiring. By dense, 0.2 probability of connection, 0.3 probability of connection, not you know, epsilon connection. Yeah. Cool. So this is an influential paper. All models are wrong. This model is wrong in a certain way. But I think the idea that you get cancellation, if we look at sort of Lompel's experiments, it's got to be the case that the raw is smaller than this is correlations, this is correlations, this is anti-correlations. When you sum them up, the total's got to be smaller. Is it an order of magnitude smaller? I bet you the answer, well, I know the answer's no. I know the answer's no. Cool. All right. And this is, I think about this all the time, so I'm happy to answer questions. Yeah. Oh, okay.
What about the recurrent wave
So we really didn't, there's no tuning in the system, right? So I don't know if people, I mean, I think David's going to talk about tuned balanced networks after the cookies. So maybe we'll let David talk about this. Or he's waving me in some way that indicates this will be said. So I need inhibition to do these things. And if we have an EI network model, and if I want my network to explain experiments, and those experiments involve a change in gain, a change in variability, and at all times the network is stable, I can do it, and I'll give you some examples of how I've done it with some collaborations with Marlene Cohen, but I often sort of feel like I'm Houdini. I've got so many constraints to satisfy, and I've only got E and I cells. And sort of the major point of this talk is that if the diversity of inhibition ultimately is going to make this job easier for me, and it's going to be easy to somewhat decouple stability and gain control and variability control, because it's going to go through different classes of interneurons are going to be responsible for these components. And this is the architecture that people have recorded between these inhibitory cell classes lend me to believe this is true. Anyway, but I'll give you an example of what I mean by them having strong tethering between these things here. So I'm going to do that with chains. So this is a collaboration with Marlene Cohen. Let me make sure I got enough time. Yeah, good. And Marlene is a visual neuroscientist. This is work she did when she was in her postdoc with John Monsell. And what Marlene's done is she's trained animals to do an orientation detection change task, and she cues the animal to say the orientation change is going to be on one or two sides of a stimulus here. And if she's recording from neurons that are in the receptive field of the cue here, then those neurons fire at higher rates. We say these neurons are in the attended state because the attention is in their receptive field, versus trials where the attention is directed away from those neurons. And all the analysis I'm going to talk about here is restricted to the stationary regime here. There's a very interesting transient. Attention doesn't seem to play a large role at firing rates here. I have other work with other people that trying to tweeze out what is really happening at the population activity, because at the level of rates, not much is happening to distinguish attended versus unattended. But out here in this steady state response, there's elevated rates. And then people have known this for a long time. I think one of the things Marlene and as well as John Reynolds sort of, they were one of the first to really look at this with large arrays of neurons. So Marlene routinely records 50, 60 cells at a time. And the overall noise correlations between pairs of neurons decreased with attention. So even though the firing rates went up, noise correlations went down. And this is a really huge effect if you're an attention neuroscientist. Typically, attention effects are really small, right? And this is a really big effect here for attention. Because I'm a mathematician, I want to know, if I see a ratio change, I want to know if it was the numerator that changed or the denominator that changed. That's the first thing you want to know. It's the numerator. So it's really the pairwise statistics in the system have somehow been shifted. The overall variability in Marlene's hands for neurons didn't change very much with attention. Okay. So along with a grad student, Tatiana Kaneshiro and Marlene, we sort of built a simple, we wanted to ask, could we explain this with sort of a simple rate equation style model here? So we have some population of E cells, some population of I cells, they're coupled. I'm going to put common fluctuations from an external source correlating these guys. And our model of attention, there's lots of different ways people hypothesize attention affects neurons, but one of them is through cholinergic pathways here. And cholinergic pathways, especially muscarin, is known to affect inhibitory neurons more than excitatory neurons. This is there's people have known this for a while, but this is a nice study from Rob Frumpke's lab, where in slice, he basically put in synaptic blockers and then dumped muscarin on, and the excitatory cell potential didn't really change. But all of the various classes of interneurons that we've been talking about, these guys all tend to depolarize with muscarin. Attention also likely affects the synaptic efficacy or the strength of synaptic inputs. That's not here in this framework. But so our model of attention is we're going to have some top-down process that's going to bias excitatory cells and inhibitory cells with a heavy amount on this and only a moderate amount on this. We're going to have the top-down attention really depolarize I cells. Okay. So, and this is sort of our Wilson-Cowan equation. This is our attention-modulated static bias. This is recurrent coupling. And then I'm going to have some external noise, and I put this inside the bracket. This is going to be colored noise. I'm going to treat this for the aficionados. This is sort of a Stratonovich-style calculation where after I do my linearization, I'll just take this to be white in the limit. So what happens here? So here's excitatory firing rate, inhibitory firing rate space. Sure, yeah.
So before you talked about correlation,
yeah.
But that was models without external models.
Well, the Renard framework had external inputs, X, right? Those were dense as well in the projection. In the Renard framework, this is external input also was dense in its projection. So there'll be common inputs from external sources.
Noisy?
These were Poisson processes. Yeah. You needed to get cancellation in a robust way. Like the same way. So this has to be, it's kosher, it's a good point. This X population is uncorrelated. There's a population of neurons in the X population. They're all uncorrelated, but they project densely. So then there'll be shared wires. But if you correlate the X's and make them now correlated Poisson processes, it is not kosher. And then now the balanced network will track this like it's a stimulus. You're right. So, yeah, good point. So this, I'm moving between networks. You're right, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I live in this world. And then Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I live in the world where I'm not allowed to do this. And I'm a frustrated times picking up on something. Absolutely. So this would be more akin to if I have a source of correlated input where the actual population is correlated, and then I'm feeding this in. And now variability and correlations will strictly be inherited, and my network, all it does is filter these things. Now I'm watching a network filter noise, right? And then I'm asking, can I change the set point of the system to change that filter, because it's a nonlinear system? And I hope to show you I can do this in a framework where I don't have to make that assumption, but although I want to make sure I get through things. All right.
Sorry, I don't think this. So the correlation that you have here is in time.
It's a white noise source. That's right.
And that's why.
Well, color noise, and then I take the limit. Yeah, it's noise though. Yeah.
Okay.
Temporal noise.
The other correlation is in the sense that they both go together, so that you have shared correlations.
That's right. So here, what I'm doing is I'm going to average. This is the population firing rate of the E cells. I'm going a little quicker. I'm glad you guys are stopping me. So this is the population firing rate of the E cells. The variability of this in the large N limit is proportional to the covariance, the average covariance between all pairs, right? So when you take sort of that field limit, this is, I think Mike Shadlin had a paper from Zohari back in the 90s where they talked about this. So if you take the summed activity of these neurons and look at the variance of the sum in the large N limit, it's basically proportional to the average correlation, covariance between each pair. So I can swap variance of the population and covariance of the pair interchangeably here. Cool. And what attention is going to do is it's going to shift the set point of the system so that the filter properties or where I'm linearizing is shifted, right? And when we do that, so here's where I start my network off, and then now I give bias to both the E and the I cell populations, but more to the I cells, then I'm able to shift my position and firing rate space. The I cells fire a lot more, the E cells fire a little bit more. But nevertheless, the overall variability in the attended state goes down. These are ISO lines, this is population variance here, and these are the ISO variance lines, and I go from a region of sort of high variability to lower variability. This is the actual variance along that curve. And the reason for this is the overall stability of the system measured through the eigenvalue becomes, the system's more stable here. So here, this is the point of this. I'm tethering that variability control and stability mechanisms are tethered in this filter-based framework here. Okay. So this is the eigen, so this is a two-dimensional system. It has two eigenvalues, and I'm choosing these J's to actually be symmetric. So one of the eigenvalues is -1, always. This is the other eigenvalue, right? So the system becomes more stable along one of the eigendirections. The other one's invariant. So the system is more stable in this regime. And because it's more stable, this fluctuations from outside gets damped more. It's just a better damped system, right? It would be cheating if I change this. If I was trying to change correlations in the network by changing the input correlations, that's cheating. Maybe it's true. There's a possibility that's the way the brain works. But it'd be cheating, it'd be trivial in my framework here. Okay. I want to make sure I get through this. So maybe very, very briefly, to answer sort of Haim's question, we can sort of do this in a different way now as well, where effectively now I can take a balanced network where now I have spatial connections in the system, where I have that excitatory neurons, their connection probability decays with the distance between the cells. The same thing for E and I, the same thing for I and E. This is actually work from Anne-Marie when she was with Alex's lab here looking at this. And we have a series of papers here. I invite you to look at them. There are ones published, ones in revision. It's on the archive though as well. And we basically look at the stability dynamics of this 2D system. And two-dimensional systems, here what I'm looking at the stability of the network as a function of the ratio of the time scale of inhibition to excitation and the spatial scale of inhibition excitation. This is how far inhibition reaches out in space, architecture-wise, relative to this. And here I'm showing a regime where everything's equal. So excitation and inhibition have equal spatial extent and equal temporal component. And we live in a stable regime here, where if you look at the stability of the various eigenmodes in the system, so here I'm looking, these are wave numbers, this is spatial eigenmodes, basically everything's stable, you get this kind of pretty asynchronous solution in our spiking network. This, as sort of David Ghulam was mentioning, this is sort of a silly place to be, especially for this number. We all know that inhibition is slower than excitation. You ask any physiologist, they say GABA A is slower than AMPA, right?
So
both the rise and decay, are slower. AMPA is the fastest. There's it's not an average. It's for stability mechanisms. It's who's the fastest. Not I can't average everybody. The fastest is going to somebody has to cancel. If excitation is the fastest guy, it's going to be hard to stabilize the system on that time scale, and that's why you get gamma. That's right. The fastest is AMPA. Both rise and decay are faster than GABA A, who's the fastest inhibitory channel. And this is something modelers, we've sort of allowed ourselves to not deal with this because we've, and I view the reason is because we sort of work in networks that doesn't that don't have spatial ordering or don't have an ordering principle at all. Erdős Reining, random graphs. So if I make inhibition slower than excitation in an Erdős Reining network, what do I get? I get pathologic synchrony, ridiculous synchrony, jailhouse raster. I call it a jailhouse raster because it looks like a jail cell, right? That doesn't make sense. If you put it on a ring, you get waves to the right, waves to the left. And the noise correlations in a network like that are also pathologically high. But when you go to 2D, it's not the case. So if I move over here, then I get activity where the noise correlation, the mean noise correlation in the system can be very small, 0.05, 5%, like experimentalists see. And it's, I'll show you in a second, it also gives you this low rank behavior. So what I've done is I've destabilized the system at the zero spatial Fourier interval. This is a hop bifurcation. All these are Turing hops up here because they're going to stabilize with a non-zero spatial mode and a non-zero frequency. A temporal mode. This is just a non-zero temporal mode, the gamma oscillation cycle. But you get patterns of activity that extend over the entire range of the network. So now if we take our attention model, and here now I don't have external sources of correlations. This is all internally generated. So I can make Heim happy and me happy on the days when I'm supposed to work on this. So in the unattended regime, you get this large correlation in the system. And in the attended regime, and I'll explain how this happens in a second, you get some top-down bias, and you end up getting very quenched noise correlations in the system. And this is to show you that this is somewhat consistent with data. This is analysis that we've done from Marlene Cohen's V4 data. And what we did is we did factor analysis. So you take the covariance matrix, you decompose it into a diagonal that just has the variances, and then the off-diagonal terms, the covariance matrix with the diagonal removed. And you look at what is the dimension of that shared component here. And the dimension of Marlene's data, there's in the unattended state, there's a very high rank one component. That means that all the neurons, for the most part, go up and down together. There's this low rank correlation that correlates neurons that are on very, very far away electrodes from one another. And what attention does is it quenches this low D mode. And that's exactly what's happening in our model as well. Our model has low rank fluctuations. You can see it here in the unattended states. The fact that you can see turbulent waves of activity go over the entire network, that's rank one. right? This guy is correlated, a guy in the middle is correlated with a guy in the edge, even though there's hundreds of microns separating them. And so what's happening here is if I believe the network is here, this is where I believe the unattended regime is. And what attention does is it changes the boundary for the stability. So I go through a hop bifurcation here, and now my system is where it used to not be stable, it now is stable. That's what this top-down attentional modulation is. So this was sort of a somewhat long detour to say that in this model here, we've also formally coupled correlation modulation and stability mechanisms here. These are very tethered concepts. So just to quickly say how gain and correlations are tethered, this goes now, forget about the balanced networks with space, I go back to that EI network that I was working on before. It's relatively trivial to show that, because what I'm doing is I'm increasing dampening, right? In this framework, I'm making the I cells better able to dampen fluctuations. Well, if I make the I cells better able to dampen fluctuations, they're also going to desensitize the neurons to stimulus, right? It's the same mechanic, right? Inhibition will cause a reduction in gain to stimulus, just like they'll do a dampening of fluctuations. So you can show that the gain of E cells is proportional to the square root of the variance of the E cells. So if attention is supposed to decrease this variance, this population variance, then attention also has to decrease gain, and that's just not what people report, right? So the way you can get out of this is you can basically bias the feed-forward input, this is sort of thalamic input, if you will, into this model, or I guess this is V4, so it's input before V4, but this is the visual input coming into the E-cells comes in with some feed-forward gain, KE. The same is true for the I-cells. And here, if KE and KI are different from one another, you can get an additive term here. And as long as I make KE very large and KI very small, then now I can have, along this same attentional path, I can have that gain goes up. So noise correlations go down and gain goes up, and I can play with parameters so I can sort of convince this is where I'm starting, this is my attentional path. My path has to be below this line, because if I'm above this line, then attention will increase correlations. That's not true. And I have to be above this line, because if I'm below this line, attention will decrease gain. That's not true. There's a reasonable amount of green here, but I can easily choose parameters where the green goes away completely. So when I was publishing this initial paper, we didn't talk a lot about this, but there's some component of fine-tuning here where I've got to choose my parameters to get me a big region of green here. And this is my Houdini, right? I don't want to do this anymore, right? I don't want to. It was okay when we were trying to use EI networks to explain one thing, stability, variability. But when I want to use this EI network to explain lots of things, I have to cheat. So that's Monsels and McAdams is the one I cited. It was way at the beginning. So then they had orient. I can go. I can show you it right now. Just, yeah. That's right. This is the gain. That's right. It wasn't from Marlene's data because she only ever used two orientations, so we couldn't. Yeah, and the firing rate goes up for my system too. Yeah. That's. This is my path is in firing rate space. So all my attention paths. So I actually have three constraints. You're absolutely right. My job is even worse. Totally true. I don't want to do that. So are we asking inhibition to do too much in these simple networks? And I think we are. And this is kind of, I still want my cookies. Yeah, we're going to be good. No problem. This is where I'm sort of shifting at least half of my lab now, is to start thinking about models of multiple interneuron subclasses. So we've seen this last week. I'm sure many people in the room here know this. There's a broad subclassification of cortical cells into these PV cells, these somatostatin or SOM cells or Martinotti cells for Andreas last week. And then this other group of cells where people, a lot of them talk about these VIP cells, but there's a large subclass of cells here. And if you start talking to more experimentalists, the SST cells are being subdivided into classes of like 7 or 8 different SST cells. I'm sure PV cells are on their way to being subclassified. So inhibition is by no means simple. The inhibitory circuit is much, much more complicated than we've been giving it credit for. So I'm going to have to take a stab. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to think about a network that has SST, pyramidal cell, and PV cells, and I'm going to build my network based on an architecture matrix from the Scanziani lab, from Pfeffer, and we'll walk through this in a second here. So what they did here is they looked at, they normalized everything to the PV pyramidal cell connection here. This is the strength of that connection. I think it's the strength of that connection times the probability of that connection, right, Emery? But they forgot the number, they didn't weigh by the number of neurons, but we did in our network here. So this is a pretty strong connection. So let's look at this. So PV cells connect strongly to pyramidal cells, that's that one. They connect strongly to themselves, that's that one. And they connect a little weaker to SST cells, or significantly weaker. Here. SST cells, they're funny in that they'll inhibit everything except themselves. Like they can't take self-criticism. They inhibit everything there. No way. Forget that. Don't talk about that. That's hard. If I'm going to distinguish between where these inputs target the neuron, is my model going to faithfully track inhibitory versus somatic? And the answer is emphatically no. Yeah, because that's just a lot of work. I should do that, but I don't.
Just threshold neurons?
No, they're going to be LIF / rate equations. Yeah, I'll do both. I have both. VIP cells, they inhibit SST cells. They also weakly inhibit PV cells. This connection is absent here. If you talk to other people, there's more and more evidence that this connection is present. Jess Carden, I think, is talking a lot about this. So this matrix is subject to change, for sure. E cells connect strongly to themselves, strongly to PV cells, strongly to, this connection will be interesting. This connection is strong, dependent on previous excitatory cell activity. This connection is a facilitating connection. So you need E cells to fire a lot in order to get this connection on. They sort of, weakly excite VIP cells. For today, I'm gonna take away all the arrows that were dashed, and I'm just gonna live with strong arrows. And I'm gonna also imagine that E cells and PV cells get inputs from an outside source, and that the VIP cell is subject to some modulation. This is where a modulatory input will come into the network, and the SST cell is the middleman of that modulation, okay, in this little framework. So this work was started with Ashok Litwin-Kumar, who now has his own lab at Columbia, and Rob Rosenbaum, who has his own lab at Notre Dame. We published a paper a while ago sort of starting this basic model, but most of the work is done by a postdoc in my lab, Hannah Boss, who's excellent. And then we're writing this up. This is also a collaboration with Anne-Marie. Okay. So what are some of the things we want to talk about? Well, this is the thalamic input targeting E and PV cells. This is the modulation. I already mentioned that. So here's some data sets that are interesting to think about when people start thinking about what these different subclasses of neurons do. So this is work from Hillel Odesnik when he was with Massimo Scanziani. And what they did is this was an awake behaving mouse running on a ball. And they showed a visual scene that changed its size. Here, this is a small visual, this is a small input, and they just changed the overall spatial scale of that input here. And pyramidal cells, these are principal cells here, they experienced suppression of their activity when the input got large. This is surround suppression, we all know this. The PV cells, his color scheme's not my color scheme, sorry. So the PV cells here, they also experience suppression. And the SST cells, the SOM cells, these were the mediators of that suppression, right? This is a push-pull dynamic here, where SOM cells get the larger and larger the input, presumably because they integrate over larger ranges of space, or the recurrent E cells feed them over larger distances. They don't actually directly get this stimulus. They only see the stimulus through E cells, right? But they have these long-range projections from E cells. Then their firing rate goes up with the size of the stimulus, and they mediate this suppression here. So this is almost like these guys are working in some inhibitory stabilized framework, because their rates go up and down together, middle branch intersection, right? And these guys just push them around.
If they're getting their input from the things that are going up and down, how come they don't go up and down?
So here he's modeling only the center. Yeah, he's modeling only the center. Yeah, there's presumably guys on the edges that are providing the input for the SOM cells to suppress that don't comprise these E cells. These are the E cells that are at the center. because they're excited for very small stimuli, so they must be in the center. So that's what did I have here? Okay, so this is a scenario where SST cells go up, ENPV go down. Cool. This is work from Bernardo Rudi's lab. Different system. This is a somatosensory system. Layer 4. The other stuff was layer 2, 3. But what Zhu et al. Did is they said, okay, what we're going to do is, I guess they're giving a thalamic input. I think this was actually a perturbation of the thalamus. I don't think it's a whisker tweak. But overall, in the naive state, SOM cells fire, FS cells fire, and pyramidal cells fire. But now what they're doing is they're going to use halorhodopsin to silence the SOM cells. So it's the same procedure, but now they're telling the SOM cells, you're not allowed to fire. They did a good job. The SOM cells turned off a lot with the laser, as you would expect, right? But what's the consequence of this? The FS cells, their firing rates actually go up now because the inhibition from SST cells is removed, and then now they're better able to inhibit pyramidal cells, so pyramidal cell firing rate go down. So here's an experiment where if I drop SST cells, pyramidal cells, PV cells go up, but E cells go down. So that's the opposite of the Adesnik stuff, right? So we kind of have, and the way that Hillel and Massimo argued their framework is there was this disinhibitory path. They actually didn't have VIP. They had surround inputs. But we can also, lots of people talk about this in the context of VIP. VIP inhibit SST cells that removes inhibition to E cells, and then they drive PV cells. So these guys are tethered together. Whereas the Rudi experiment, and also some work from Anne-Marie that she'll show you Friday, more involved this pathway here. So there's two disinhibitory pathways. So how do we think about these two pathways working at the same time in a circuit? So we do some math, figure that out. It's linear systems math. It's relatively straightforward. So here I'm going to have some population of E cells, population of SST cells, population of pyramidal cells, and I'm going to envision some perturbation to the SST cells. This could be mediated through VIP inputs, right, if I wanted to. So there's going to be some overall change in the firing rate of the SST cells, and I want to know what the impact of this perturbation is on E cells with this entire circuit intact, right? So one way to do this, one clearly important pathway in this perturbation is going to be the direct monosynaptic connection between the SST cells and the E cells. That's this pathway. So in a linear framework, I would imagine that if I knew what this perturbation was, then this is going to be linearly related to this perturbation by the strength of that path. But there's lots of paths in the system, right? This is the one synapse path, there's the two synapse paths, there's the three synapse paths, there's all the paths. This is effectively a Taylor expansion. What I do is we solve this system as a linear system, and whenever you solve a linear system, you've got the inverse of the identity matrix minus W if this is a Wilson-Cowan system, and this is a Taylor expansion of that, as long as the eigenvalues of W are within the unit sphere. So the system's stable. I can't do linear systems analysis around an unstable point or didn't get anything meaningful. But I can do this full expansion. And then if that perturbation is only to the E cells, we can redo the sum and we get two effective pathways that pop out. We, of course, have the determinants still here, so all of the connections matter. But in the numerator, so if we just care about the sign of this, then there's two key pathways that come out. The pathways that Hillel and the Rudi lab said was true. This is the Hillel pathway. You also have to take into account the monosynaptic connections onto PV cells. This is going to be this component here. This is the suppressive component. And then we have this pathway, which is the disinhibition through PV cells, and this will sort of be additive here. And so it's not crazy that these two labs had these opposing results. They're working in different animals in different layers, and by just changing these parameters and changing one of the key parameters, of course, is whether this is larger than this, and then also what is beta. I didn't tell you what beta is. Beta is the gain, the gain of the transfer of the PV cells. This is the gain of the transfer to the E cells. It makes total sense that this pulls all the way out because we're looking at E cell responses, so this all has to be proportional to their gain, their FI gain, if you will. But then beta P appears in here in a non-trivial way. So when beta P is sufficiently large, then it's possible to flip this gain to go from the Hillel style, the Hillel Massimo side to the Rudi side here. Right? So it's not inconceivable that you can do this. All right, this is really probing the nonlinearities of the system, right? Because beta, as I change, me changing beta p means I'm sweeping over nonlinearity in the system. If all the neurons were linear, beta p is the slope. If they're linear, there's one slope. That's it. This is really probing nonlinearities. All right, so now let's talk about stability, and that's looking at whether the firing rates go up or down. Now let's, so this is exactly this. So this is the scenario where as we modulate the system, then initially, this is the PV cells, they'll go down and the E cells go up, but eventually you transition into, we'll talk about this switch in a second, eventually you transition into the ISN regime where everything goes up here. But in this regime here, you have that the PV cells slightly go down and the E cells go up here. That's the Bernardo-Rudy framework. If we look at the gain in the system, where now I'm just looking at the rate of change of the E cell firing rate with respect to I-STIM, the gain goes up for a while and then sort of peaks. And now our SIMs over here, you notice there's a broken axis. The SIMs have a data point. So what I should say, this is solutions to the Wilson-Cowan equation. That's in the color. The dots are Monte Carlo solutions for a network of integrating fire models, where my Wilson-Cowan nonlinearity is the mean first passage time for a white noise-driven LIF here. So it's a classic sort of mean field approach. So this works over here in a large range, but eventually when you push the modulation too far, this rate equation framework completely fails to describe the spiking network SIMs. And the spiking network SIMs live up here. So what's happening here? So this is raster plots of our spiking network SIM. We're in the regime where it works. We get a little higher. We start to get very, very high firing here, as you would expect. But in this regime here, you've destabilized the fixed point. And then now you get these sort of massive pathologic oscillations like I was talking about here. And you might expect this, because what you're trying to do is get the PV cells to mediate a gain control, but they're also the only interneuron that's responsible for stability. You're asking the PV cells to do too much. They're supposed to stabilize the E cells, but you're also shutting them off to perform a gain modulation. And that's where you get into trouble, right? You can't ask them to do that. In this pathway, everything works really well. The PV cells, they're always there to do stability, but yet this direct pathway can now modulate the E cells with never having to worry about the E cells going unstable. So you get this, this is now the Adesnik framework, where as we turn the SST cells off, both the pyramidal cells and the PV cells, their firing rates go up. The gain monotonically rises, so there's a large range of gain here, if you can experience, and if we sample this, we're always sort of in a stable regime. So that's one take-home message here, is by partialing out gain control mechanisms and stability mechanisms into two cell classes, we get a very, very reasonable network that you can have a large change in gain and you never worry about the system going epileptic.
Right?
That's a gamma oscillation. Yeah, it's like 50 milliseconds. Yeah, that's like a. But this is not a good model of cortex, right? This is like that. So this is this is an extreme gamma oscillation, right? Where everybody fires multiple times. I mean, the rates are really high here. I don't think this is a region that I want to study in cortex. This is fine. Yeah, and weak gamma oscillations are okay too. This is just ridiculously large. Yeah. Remember, the firing rates are like way off. The gain is way off the chart here. The firing rate should also be way off the chart. So that's one take-home message here. Cool, yeah, no problem. So that's looking at gain. We can make this a little bit more formal. I'll go through this very quickly. So here, for the most part here, I'm gonna ignore this connection until a little bit later. So then really I'm just dealing with an EI network. And if I wanna compute the gain of this system for different biases, mu E and mu P, that's how I'm gonna sample rate spaces. I'm gonna set the operating point of my neurons. By changing these two, I can change their fixed point. And I can analyze the gain, or the gain of the system around that stable point. And you can compute what that gain is using the same basic tricks we had before. And that's basically what we have. We sort of expect this. We have a high gain, so pyramidal cells are very sensitive to stimulus when the PV cells are very weakly driven, or so when their firing rates are low. And the more and more the PV cells turn on, the lower and lower the gain of the pyramidal cells. All right, so this is this tethering between gain and stability that we talked about a second ago. Yep. Sure.
firing the fixed point.
Yeah, that's right. You tell me what firing rate you want, and that uniquely determines the biases. And then those biases determine the gain of the system, the betas, and then that plugs into this formula. So these mu's are just overall static biases. Yeah, and all I'm doing is changing these mu's. So if you tell me you want to have E cells fire at 10 hertz and PV cells fire at 5 hertz, I can uniquely determine what the input mu's for a fixed J matrix, what the input mu's are to get me to that point. And then I can linearize my system around that point, and I can tell you how sensitive the E cells are to an input stimulus at that point. Yes? Yeah, so you're right. So here I'm just looking at the slope of the response function locally around its operating point. Yeah, that's my definition of linear gain, right? I guess if I want to have the full nonlinearity of the system, then what do we have to do? I guess we'd have to then look at the system at the two different points and then take the difference of the rates. Yeah, I could do that too. That would involve me analyzing the system at two different points, not one. We could do that. So this is only gain. I'll talk about the stability in a second, but that's right. This is just the gain. This is how sensitive. So E cells in this little framework, E cells are very sensitive to stimuli when the PV cells aren't suppressing them. That's all, yeah. And then they're not sensitive at all when the PV cells are really squashing them. This is just saying that this negative feedback loop here really sort of kills gain control.
Yeah, my question was more
or kills gain. Yeah, that makes it easier. If this symmetry makes it easier to compute this, it makes it a smaller expression. Yeah.
And I guess that there will be like a huge regime in which you just couldn't achieve anything, right? Because you just wouldn't be able to scale that.
So there's up in this white region here, there's a line here which is it'll be a zero eigenvalue or a one eigenvalue, but a zero eigenvalue in the dynamical system. Where up here, it's not even stable. Right, so you can't have gain up here because I have to linearize around a fixed point that's stable. And in this regime here, there is no stable fixed point. So it's kind of nonsensical to talk about gain in this region here. So stability measure, I'm going to use a stability measure that's very, very similar to what a control system engineer would do. So here's my sort of Wilson-Cowan dynamics. I'm going to envision a small perturbation here. And then this sort of gives me, this looks at now I'm looking at the dynamics of that perturbation. I'm asking whether that's a stable perturbation, whether it decays back to zero or not. So you can write it down as sort of the sum of eigenvalues minus one because of the minus r here times the various eigenmodes, left and right eigenvectors of the system. And let's just imagine for a second we had, we have a 1D here, really a 2D system where I have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. This is lambda 1. He would have a complex buddy lambda 1 bar down here, but I'm just going to plot this guy. One problem about classic stability measures is you can imagine a perturbation that basically just pushes this up here. This is my perturbed eigenvalue. And you would say, well, this system's equally stable, right? The real component's minus 2 in both cases. So from a stability point of view, a dynamical system's supposed to say equal stability. Don't worry about it. But if you put some noisy fluctuations on this system, then really what you should do is not look at the stability of sort of the zero the zero Fourier mode solution here. There's really stability in a spectral sense. If X is some broadband input, like white noise, like you might expect from a finite size fluctuation correction, then really what you need to think about is a whole continuum of lambdas here, one for every omega. This is the omega is equal to zero case. I'm going to make the assumption that this filter, lambda omega, decays to zero at high frequencies, so everything comes here to zero. But a reasonable way to think about stability then, in a graded sense, some graded sense of stability, is to say, well, actually the upper one is less stable than the lower one because this curve approaches one. The distance between, the minimal distance between this upper curve and one, where we lose stability, is smaller than this. So both of these cases are stable, but the upper curve is less stable. If you give broadband fluctuations, they will be less damped in this system here. Okay. So when we now look at this framework here, we now see that, oops, this fell off. This should be very stable here. This is high stability, and this is very, very low stability up here in this plot. Okay, so now let's use these two metrics of gain and stability to probe this system. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a perturbation. I'm going to drop the firing rate of my SST cells by giving them some negative input here. What that's going to do is that's going to cause my excitatory neurons to increase in this particular parameter regime I'm looking at here. Same thing for the PV cells, they'll also increase. That increase is basically a vector. Here I'm looking at the steady state increase. That's a vector. And then now if I live in this system, if I start at a point in this space and then apply my perturbation, and if it's a weak perturbation, then that's the consequence of this perturbation. In this particular regime here, the PV cell firing rate goes down, the E cell firing rate goes up. That's the consequence of that perturbation. I can do that for another point. I can do that for all points. And I get a vector field, not a dynamical vector field. This isn't the zero of the right-hand side of an ODE. It's sampling the nonlinearities of my system. If my system was linear, all these arrows would go in the same way. But because my system's nonlinear, the effect of the perturbation that I give depends on the operating point of the network before the perturbation. And then now we can overlay this for how a perturbation like this would change stability. So perturbations over here will tend to go from a region of low stability to sort of higher stability, whereas out here, they're sort of maybe hugging ISO lines. These are the ISO stable lines here. So we effectively want a perturbation that keeps us away from, well, this is high stability. So we don't want to go in the low stability regime. We don't want perturbations to put us here because the system's going to blow up, right? So, and then this is the gain. If we want high gain, we kind of want to be here as well. This is this gain stability dilemma that we have here. And if I slowly titrate this connection, the arrows start shifting so that it's worse. It's worse and it's worse and it's worse. And then eventually perturbations where you have this disinhibitory path here, this SPVE path being dominant, these perturbations will eventually, if you want high gain, you're going to have low stability, so forth. But now let's do it over here. Let's do the other pathway, the safe pathway. So now we have the arrows pointed this way, and now this modulation is a negative. The VIP cells are inhibiting the SST cells. And then now as we start to turn on this connection, because we know it's there, it's a real connection, the arrows start pushing away, oops, so that we can have arbitrarily high gain, but we can have increases of gain where stability either stays the same or becomes, the system becomes more stable, right? So pathways like this are very safe modulatory pathways. Pathways like this, you flirt with danger in these pathways, okay? So now in the last sort of, I think, yeah, we can do it in the last 5 minutes. I wanna show you what happens if we put this connection back. So here we're gonna play a little experiment where I'm back to this system. Here's a framework where I'm gonna have no stimulus, I'm going to have stimulus, and I'm going to have stimulus plus a modulator, and that modulator will go only to the SST cells. You'll see it here. So I'm working in a regime where the SST cells have a high spontaneous firing rate, and these guys have low firing rates here. So now if we put a stimulus in, the SST cells don't see that stimulus right now. I will put this connection in a second. The SST cells don't see this stimulus, so their firing rate doesn't change. The EPV system is in this ISN network regime where they'll both increase here. You don't have to be ISN for that to happen here because they're both positive inputs. But their firing rates go up together, okay? But now what's my modulator going to do? My modulator is going to come in and it's going to completely turn off. This is like the Uber VIP pathway where VIP cells just clamp these guys down. And then what's going to happen? The firing rates for these guys go up, the firing rate for these guys go up. So the modulator increases the gain of the system. If we compare the non-stimulated to the stimulated plus modulator, that's a higher change in the gain sense of Heim, where you're really looking at two firing rates that are order one away from each other, right? Compared to the stimulated case. Okay. Now let's put this connection back. So for the one of the first times, now we're looking at really a fully connected system here, in the sense that everybody gets feedback. So in this regime here, I'm gonna these fire at such low rates that who cares about this connection? So now I'll put a stimulus in, and then now the SST cells see that stimulus because there's this connection. But there's now this negative feedback loop here, which stunts the increase here. This change here to here is less impressive than that, because the SST cells are suppressing responses here. Then now if the VIP cells come in and kill them, then they go back. So this is the same as this here. So really, when you have this recurrent feedback connection, the modulation really changes gain significantly when there's this E to S connection, because we're going from here to here compared to here to here. So the presence of this E S connection can really allow a modulator that turns off SST cells to have a big change in the response of the system. So that's kind of a new statement, or somewhat new in the context of this circuit, right? Easy to find, easy to follow. And sort of in the last minute, I'll sort of talk about the consequences of noise correlations. This path here, as you would expect, noise correlations blow up, because this is the dangerous path. This is the path that pushes you across that stability axis. Everybody's firing haywire. That's not good. So noise correlations go off the charts. In this path, noise correlations actually go up and then they go down. And again, dots are spike count correlations in a network of LIF neurons. So noise correlations are non-monotonic with gain. So this is a decoupling. You can have increases in gain and decreases in noise correlations relatively robustly here. And the reason for this is we can use our linear response theory to effectively get an expression for the noise correlations between a pair of E cells. They have two sources. They have noise correlations that are internally generated between the PV cells and the E cells. This is the recurrent EPV cell link. A here is the autocorrelation of the PV cells. This is the autocorrelation of the E cells. If they were Poisson processes, this would just be the firing rate of those neurons, right? So this is internally generated correlations as viewed by the E cells. That's why the gain of the E cells is squared present. This is correlations due to common projections from SST cells onto E cells. So this is internal correlations. This is external correlations, because the SST cells aren't part of the circuit in this first case. And this is what happens. As we modulate the system, we see that the internal correlations grow larger with the modulation. Why? Because the modulation is allowing them to fire more and more and more. So that means their autocorrelations get larger and larger and larger. This thing grows monotonically. Correlations due to this term, they start to grow and then they decrease. The reason they start growing is because there's this beta E squared term. So the E cells have to be firing at a sufficiently high rate in order to let SST cell correlations through. But eventually, if I start turning off the SST cells, well, then this goes down and you get this non-monotonic behavior. This is when PI is zero. What PI is PI is that loop, that S to PV cell to E loop. That's the bad loop in some sense. Although in this case, if we let that loop exist, then the green curve gets squashed, because we have a PI minus a PII. So the green curve gets squashed, and overall noise correlations, which are in gray, they go down. So if we have this mixed connection, so if we allow this connection to exist here, then noise correlations, as passed through the SST cells, are less effective. And that's easy to see. These SST cells are trying to correlate these E cells with common projections, but then those same common projections will go here and come over here with a minus sign. It's cancellation, right? Common fluctuations here directly, common fluctuations indirectly with a minus sign. They kill, right? That's why it goes. That's exactly where this minus sign comes from. But all of this is perhaps moot, because this connection, the E to S connection, when you put that in, noise correlations just drop like a stone. This equation no longer is valid because I have this connection here. But what's happening here is, in some sense, I've got two decorrelating circuits. This decorrelating circuit here and this decorrelating circuit here. So I've got sort of two Renard networks side by side. And then you put them together and they really decorrelate, right, in this system.
Even though S doesn't connect to itself?
That's a great question. Yeah, so even though S doesn't connect to itself, so this is the much better. This is the PV connecting to itself is critical for stability, right? So if S didn't connect to itself, So the reason why S has to connect to itself is if I get rid of this and PV cells don't connect to itself, you're out of luck. The system's not going to be stable. But I don't have to worry. See, this is in some sense my point. One of my points is that SST cells don't have to connect to themselves because the PV cells are already stabilizing these guys. I don't need the SST cells to connect to themselves because they're not responsible for stability. If they were responsible for stability, they would have to. Yeah, but they're free to not connect to themselves because the PV cells take the job.
They can still decorrelate
because the decorrelation is just about passing correlations here with a positive and then here with a negative. Yep, and they'll remain stable because the E cells are stable, because the PV cells make them stable because they connect to themselves. Yep, it's a nice self-consistent story. Conclusions, what did I do here? I tried to show you how multiple inhibitory cell classes allows us to have stable gain modulations. So we can decouple stability and gain modulation with each other if they're conducted by different interneuron classes. I can have a high gain state with low correlations. Great, I can sort of somewhat break that Houdini chain. If SOM cells project to both E and PV cells, the stability is increased a lot. They suppress noise correlations. And then if E cells project to SOM cells, there's an amplification of gain and we suppress noise correlations. So we can sort of break this as well. So in conclusion, all this work was done by really Hannah Bowles, the last part of it. The spatial temporal stuff was Chung-Chung Huang. They're both excellent postdocs in my lab. I'm very lucky. Along with collaborators, Anne-Marie, who's here, and you'll hear more from her on Friday on related topics. And thanks for your attention. Alessandro.
This is very nice. Do you have any idea for what could be produced with the further structure that you have, like the basket and the chandelier
side? I think we have a framework to start discussing that, right? Like part of it, I've moved out of the phase plane. Bard and John and everyone were lucky because they have phase planes, right? And I'm trying to do this analysis without phase planes because I put in one extra dimension. So phase planes are gone. So this sort of linear systems analysis, it scales, four cell classes, five cell classes, six cell classes, the same kind of analysis can be done. It might give you more complicated expressions, right? But we can do that. We're not there yet, but I think this pathway, at least, is one path we can walk for that problem.
Yeah, maybe one question and
then coffee. Right, so one fun thing I can think about. So here, where is it, this one? No, the noise correlation one. Not that one, boom, this here. Okay, so here, this is when this pathway is inactive, right? I get this, let's pretend we live here. So my noise correlation is the black, that's the total noise correlations. That's when this pathway is inactive. This pathway is a facilitating pathway, right? So if the E cells have not recently been activated, right? They're sort of firing at a low state, then I would expect that this is a reasonable model of the circuit because I should just forget about this pathway. But if I get the E cells to fire a lot, E cells are, they get a bunch of stimulus that makes them fire a lot, then this pathway turns on. And if that pathway turns on, boom, noise correlations in the E cells drop like a stone. So that would be one prediction, right? I can sort of toggle between I can toggle between the facilitated synapse and the non-facilitated synapse. So that's one low-hanging fruit for how I want to start pushing in. Plus, you're absolutely right. All these connections are subject to depression and facilitation. We need to start thinking about that. I mean, Misha's been doing it for 20 years, but the rest of us have to pick up. Cool. Thanks.